Today, we're going to hear a story that you may or may not be familiar with. It was a fairly well-known story, in 1866 anyway. The ladies are going to take us to a small community in the Appalachian Mountains of North Carolina, known as Happy Valley. Happy Valley was situated in an area between Peterson and Ferguson, not far from where Daniel Boone settled about 100 years earlier. Now, things were rough in those parts in 1866. The Civil War had just recently ended, and the young men lucky enough to survive were returning home to a South that had been destroyed. And in Happy Valley, like most of the South, there was a class divide between wealthy plantation owners and the impoverished folks who lived in the hills, many of which became sharecroppers after the war, a choice that would almost certainly guarantee a life of poverty. Now, some folks considered the people who lived in those hills so depraved that they coined a phrase, "It's a wise child that knows its father." Not knowing your baby daddy was perhaps just one symptom of this moral decline. During the war, there was an explosion of STDs throughout military camps. Seeing as how there was a shortage of doctors, sometimes only one for every 300 soldiers, these men had to be creative in the ways they would try to treat the ailments and diseases that plagued them. Some going as far as to infect themselves with syphilis or gonorrhea. Now you may think, how or why would they do that? You see, the outbreak of syphilis and gonorrhea came on the shirt tails of an outbreak of smallpox. Now, if you contracted smallpox in 1866, you were certain there was no hope of recovery, especially during a war where access to sanitary conditions and vaccinations were not a luxury that these men had. Now, these soldiers resorted to more basic, desperate measures by using their knives to cut themselves. They would cut the sores of someone infected with smallpox and rub the pus into their open wounds, introducing the virus into their bloodstream in an attempt to give themselves a very crude vaccination. One large problem with this, aside from the obvious, is that smallpox and syphilis look very similar. And seeing as how then, just like today, military bases had a healthy supply of prostitutes and venereal disease, in a sad attempt to vaccinate themselves from smallpox, many of these men accidentally infected themselves with syphilis and gonorrhea. Now, I imagine trying to explain that to their wives when they returned home from the war was not an easy task. If you don't already, you may feel like taking a shower when you get done listening to the ladies tell this story.
Probably heard this story.
Mm-hmm.
Many of our listeners will be familiar with it, I'm sure. Got most of my information from a book by John Foster called Lift Up Your Head, Tom Dooley. Another book by Kathy Pickens called True Crime Stories of Western North Carolina. And two websites. One was the archives at wilksnc.org, and the other was findagrave.com. My disclaimer is that this episode is not violently graphic. However, the tale is very sordid, and is not appropriate for young listeners at all.
Tom Dooley was wild.
Oh, yeah. As you know, Darlene, love triangles have long been the cause of many a murder.
Mm-hmm.
And today's story includes a love triangle that ends in a young woman's death with some twist included. It has all the elements of a love triangle gone wrong. Jealousy, lies, lust, adultery. There's nothing new under the sun.
Right.
I should also add that there are many legends surrounding this story woven in with the facts. Lots of myths, because this stuff has been passed down through generations in the Appalachian Mountains. And so sometimes the stories get passed enough that you lose some of the actual detail.
Right.
You know how that goes. So I gave the version that I could find the most factual information for, but still some of my details may be incorrect.
Okay.
I did my best to try to keep it factual. And where it's not factual, I try to point out that this is just hearsay or a legend. So let me tell you what happened.
Okay.
In late May 1866, 22-year-old Laura Foster was riding her father's horse on her way to meet up with her beau, Tom Dooley. They had arranged to meet secretly at an old, unused blacksmith shop on the mountainside that they called the Bates Place. And according to her friend, Betsy Scott, Laura had confided that she and Tom were running away to get married. In fact, Laura had taken her father's horse without permission, and he was none too happy about that. But when her father's horse returned home the next day without Laura, he was appeased for a little bit. Laura, however, never did return, and so a search began for her shortly afterwards.
Okay.
You know what else began? The rumor mill.
Right.
It turns out Laura had a bit of a reputation of being easy, and people knew she had been seeing Tom Dooley. They were already speculating things, that stuff like she was pregnant or that she had been murdered because of that.
Right.
The talk had begun.
Now, was he missing too, or just
Laura?
Her. Oh, okay.
And just like we do today, the people of the small town were already immediately suspicious of her significant other. We always say, look at the husband or the boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Eyes were already on Tom Dooley a little bit. So he figured he had better get the heck out of Dodge, and he took off, which only caused him to look more guilty.
Right.
And their suspicions were not unfounded. So I'm going to back up and tell you a little bit about him. Tom Dooley, and that is actually spelled Dula, D-U-L-A, but this is the Appalachian Mountain area, and so everybody pronounces that Dooley.
Okay.
He had been born in 1845 in Elkville, North Carolina, in Wilkes County. Elkville is now known as Ferguson these days. And when the war between the states broke out, the Civil War, Tom was in his early teens. He enlisted in the Confederate Army at the age of 17, and he served throughout the war. Toward the end of the war, he was actually taken prisoner for a time. But eventually, the war was over. He was freed. He returned home to North Carolina. It is said that Tom had an aversion to hard work, but he had quite the reputation with the ladies.
Okay.
He was considered a good-looking fella, and he was known to be quite the fiddle player.
Okay.
You know how women love a musician.
Yes.
So I'm sure that was part of his appeal. It was rumored that he was stepping out with a few ladies at the same time, and one of them was even married.
Not good.
Nope. Her name was Ann Foster Melton. They were neighbors, and they had grown up fairly close together. They had been known to be seeing each other before he had gone off to war, when they were in their early teens. And when I say that, I'm talking 13, 14.
Okay. So yes. They were dating. Or just friends?
Well, some would say they actually were having a sexual relationship, even as early as that.
Okay.
In fact, her mother, Anne's mother, had caught them in the act, she said, before.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Anne went on to marry a man by the name of James Melton when she was between 14 and 15. And you know, young marriage wasn't uncommon then.
Sure.
It sounds really crazy right now to even say that. 14. And that did not put a damper on her relationship with Tom at all. They continued to carry on.
Did she love her husband?
I don't know. She stayed with him. As I tell the story, it's going to get really interesting about how that went down. But she obviously did love Tom.
Right.
So I'm not sure why they didn't just marry. However, they didn't. They just continued to carry on their relationship as before. And she actually herself had a reputation of being promiscuous, as well as being brash and somewhat lazy.
Okay.
And she could be quite the scrapper as well. She was not afraid of a fight.
Hmm. That's so weird for that time. We just don't. That's not what we have envisioned.
Yeah. What do you picture? Just,
I don't know, like ladies.
Mild mannered.
Right. Definitely not sexually promiscuous.
I don't think she would be considered a lady back then. It would have been more like a broad.
Right.
If just saying, like, during that time, that would have been probably the thing that she would have been considered. Her husband, James, was well aware of that relationship.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. It appears that he just turned a blind eye to it. It does make you think that he was.
Right. Like, if she just married him to take care of her.
Maybe for some security.
Tom had an aversion to work.
So. She actually did have a bad home life. Her mother was a drunkard. She had younger siblings. They lived in the poor part of the valley there, North Carolina. And so maybe it was for some security. Although James Melton, he was a cobbler fixing shoes. But they lived in like a one-room house. So it wasn't like he was well-to-do.
Okay.
So in testimony later by Anne's cousin, Pauline, and I'm going to talk about her more in a minute. She plays a big part of this story. But she states that while they lived in that one-room house that had three beds in it, and there were times when James slept in one bed while Anne and Tom slept in the other.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. I thought, my word, that is crazy. Interestingly enough, Tom was also seeing one of Anne's cousins named Laura Foster, the Laura Foster who had been gone missing that May.
Okay, Anne's cousin.
Anne's cousin. So Anne was Anne Foster, and then she became Anne Foster Melton when she married James. She and Tom are still seeing each other, and Tom's also seeing her cousin, Laura Foster.
Okay, gotcha.
So far, that's where we are. So Tom was sleeping with both of these women around the same time alternately. And it was during this time that, surprise, surprise, Tom found out that he had a sexually transmitted disease called syphilis.
Oh, no. And that's like a death sentence, right?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Not all the time. And he was furious. So furious that he confided to a friend, "I'm going to put through the one that gave it to me." Meaning he was going to kill him. He told Anne that he had gotten this from Laura Foster because he gave it to Anne.
Okay, well, why wouldn't he think maybe he picked it up somewhere? Since obviously,
why wouldn't he?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't he? And it doesn't sound like he was concerned about who had given it to him. He was mad, but he wasn't concerned about who he may be giving it to.
Who he gave it to. Exactly.
Well, he gave it to Anne. And so, what do you think Anne did? She gave it to James.
Oh.
Because, crazy enough, he also maybe was not constrained to just being with these two ladies. Turns out, Anne Melton also has another cousin named Pauline Foster.
Keeping it in the family.
Yeah. It's crazy. I'm reading this stuff thinking, this is crazy. This is like the stuff you see on soap operas or whatever.
Oh, my goodness.
Some neighbors had seen him stepping out. Or maybe, should I say, sneaking into the woods with Pauline on more than one occasion. He most likely was sleeping with Pauline. Let's talk about her for a second.
Okay.
Pauline had come to visit Anne and James under the pretense that she was visiting her grandfather that lived close by. She was actually there to seek medical help for syphilis.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. Or the pock, as they called it. So she's already being treated for it. While there, you remember how I said Anne was kind of lazy?
Yes.
So she's staying with Anne and James, and chores are needing to be done around there. And so she stays and helps. So she's kind of living with them now, helping
Anne's
with the
making
chores.
The best of it, right?
Yes, she is. That Anne, like, you're going to come to see. She's conniving. So now Pauline's in one bed. James is most of the time in another bed. And Anne's in the third bed, sometimes with Tom. And Pauline actually says that.
Now, does Anne know that Pauline has syphilis?
I don't know. I don't think she does know at this point.
Okay.
Now, again, I could not find that, but just in my reading, I'm like, how come nobody thinks Pauline started this outbreak of syphilis?
Right.
She came to be treated for it. But in her testimony on trial, she did admit that she had come to Watauga County for the purpose of getting medicine from Dr. Carter for it. And she was staying at the Melton place, helping them out with the chores, like we had said before, because she needed the money to buy her medicine. So she admitted to that on the stand. She does become a key witness in this trial. In her testimony, she says that she didn't sleep with Tom. But given the fact that she's being treated for syphilis, I don't really believe that.
Right.
I mean, I'm just thinking.
And there were eyewitnesses?
That saw them slipping off into the woods together. She said that she was doing that as a blind, that Anne had asked her to do it, to like put people off, I guess, to make them think that they were seeing each other. So she said, I was just doing it as a blind. Actually, the reason Pauline was being a blind or a decoy is probably because Anne was trying to hide it from James, that Tom was there to see her instead of Pauline. And I had said James may have been turning a blind eye. But the more I read, I guess they probably were still trying to deceive him. So maybe he wasn't turning a blind eye. But I still think he may have been seeing Pauline.
Yes.
And maybe they were just keeping that from Anne.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, Anne is jealous of Laura Foster, and so she fully believes it's Laura that had given it to everybody.
Okay.
She's not as jealous of Pauline for some reason.
Hmm, okay.
But maybe she feels like Tom really did have feelings for Laura, and so she's jealous of her. But maybe she doesn't care too much that he's, you know, just sleeping with Pauline as long as he doesn't like her or love her.
Golly.
That is speculation on my part just based on what I've read.
Okay.
So here's Tom giving Laura syphilis, most likely, and blaming her for giving it to everybody else when really she's probably not the one. So here's what happens, because he's mad about this. The details do get a little muddy. This timeline of events is mainly drawn from accounts of Pauline's testimony during the trial.
Okay.
And we will talk about the trial, but right now this is just like a timeline. Thursday, May 24, 1866, Anne told Pauline that Tom has given her the pock and that he had contracted it from Laura. Therefore, Anne said she was going to kill Laura Foster, and she threatens to kill Pauline if she tells anybody else about it.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm thinking at this point, Pauline's probably not going to tell her, well, I'm seeing Dr. Carter for it myself. I came here to get treatment.
Yeah.
She's probably keeping that under her hat.
Mm-hmm.
That same day, Tom went down to the Melton house where Anne and James lived, and he asked Pauline for some alum for some sores on his mouth.
Oh.
Now, one of the symptoms of syphilis is you can get sores on your mouth.
Okay.
So he goes down there to get some medicine for it from Pauline. He also borrows a canteen while he's there. Later that same morning, Tom visited Lottie Foster's house. That's Anne's mother.
Okay.
And he borrowed a mattock. And most people will know, but if I'll just tell the listeners, that's like a heavy tool that's for digging. Then a short bit later, a neighbor saw Tom digging with that mattock in an area along Reedy Branch, which is like between the path between Tom's house and Laura's house.
Oh.
And he asked him, you know, what he was doing. And Tom said he was making the road wider so he could walk it more safely at night. The area that he is seen in, it actually is only about 200 to 300 yards from where Laura Foster is eventually found. So just keep that in mind. Around 3 o'clock that same day, Anne left her house with Tom and was gone the rest of the day, not getting back until the next morning early, just a little before daybreak. So that would have been Friday, May the 25th. When Pauline inquired where she had been all night, she claimed that she, Tom, and her mother were up all night drinking whiskey together. I told you her mom was like a drunkard.
Right.
Supposedly, that canteen that Tom had borrowed earlier in the day had been filled with whiskey and they were drinking on it. Or that was what she said.
Okay.
Pauline did notice that the clothes Anne had been wearing, her dress, was wet and her shoes. Pauline went outside to do some chores. She came back shortly after and she finds Tom in there talking with Anne in hushed tones. Okay, that was all on Friday, May the 25th. Also on Friday, May 25th, That was the morning. Laura Foster woke up that morning early because someone came and woke her up. It was Tom. It is claimed that Tom had come by her house earlier, pre-dawn, awakened her, and told her that they were going to run off together. He leaves. They're going to meet up later. She gets her father's horse, along with a bundle of her clothes. She leaves the house. And while she's on her way to meet him is when she runs into her friend, Betsy Scott, and she tells her that she is running off to marry Tom.
That's sad. She was probably excited.
I think she was. Around that time, supposedly she and Tom were like walking from different directions to meet each other.
Okay.
Tom was seen by two different people as he was walking to meet Laura. One of those people asked if he had been after the woman, quote unquote. And Tom replied, no, he had quit that. That neighbor noticed that Tom's pants were wet with dew. Tom's mother said he later did come home that evening, complaining of chills, and that he slept fitfully that night. And that's also the chills and fever. Those are symptoms of syphilis as well.
Right.
He did leave again that Saturday morning. Okay, so let's back up to Friday. Laura's father, whose name is Wilson Foster, he was searching for her, going to neighbors' homes, asking if they had seen her, that kind of thing.
Was he worried about her or the horse?
Well, funny you should ask. I guess you know that part of the story. Actually, he wasn't really searching for her as much as he was searching for his mare, which Laura had taken. He didn't seem really to care too much about where she was. In fact, it is said that on that very evening, he was at the Melton Place, the home of James and Anne, drinking and carrying on with James, Anne, Pauline, and some of the other neighbors, and in the presence of all of them, made the statement, he didn't care what happened to Laura as long as he got his horse back.
Aww.
Yeah, and he would kill Laura himself if he found her.
Oh my goodness. No wonder this girl has issues and she has daddy issues. So maybe that's why she's promiscuous.
Right. She's looking for love.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You do have to feel so bad for her. He must have been happy the next morning on Saturday when his mare came home of its own accord. And there was a rope, a partially broken off rope attached to it where it had been tethered somewhere, but it had made it home. But there were still no signs of his daughter.
Was he worried about her at that point?
I don't know if he's worried. I mean, after that comment, I don't really even think I could say he worried.
Right.
But I guess he does realize maybe something has happened to her. He and the neighbors, they do begin searching to see if they can find Laura.
Well, I got to thinking, though, about her dad. Back then, a mare was probably like a car. And I'm thinking, if one of my kids, you know, stole my car, and they're like, we're going to elope, and they took my car. Well, I'm thinking about how I talk, and I say things like I don't, you know what I mean? I could hear myself being like, I'm going to kill her.
Right, so maybe he said it offhandedly, not so much like I'm really going to kill her, or I would, but maybe just because he doesn't know yet what's become of her. Maybe he doesn't really know that she's in danger.
That something's wrong, so he's like, I'm going to beat her, I'm going to kill her, you know?
Okay, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt there a little bit.
Okay, it was just a thought.
Okay, Darlene, I'm going to give you that. I know you like to always look at both sides of an issue.
Yes, I do.
So we'll see. All of those events had happened between Thursday, May 24th, and Saturday, May 26th. Just after they realized Laura was missing, the neighbors had begun searching, and at first, they didn't find anything. They came up empty. So it was about a month after her disappearance. Some of the searchers did find a piece of rope tied to a dogwood tree up near the Bates place, which is where she had told Betsy she was meeting Tom. It was a piece of like flaxen rope that matched a piece of rope that had been fastened to her horse's, her father's horse. There were also two piles of horse dung nearby, indicating that the horse had been tied up for a while, long enough to go twice.
Okay.
Very close to that tree, the men found a dark spot on the ground, and it like had a really offensive odor. They're thinking that's blood, and so they're assuming that's probably Laura Foster's blood. But still, no body was found at that time. They found the remains of a rope where a horse had been tied. They found the blood spot, or what they assumed to be a blood spot on the ground, but no body.
Now, was this a whole month later?
It was a month later.
Okay.
And I believe those searches had been going on and off.
Okay,
if
gotcha.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Around this time, Anne's husband, James Melton, informed Tom that there was talk he was the one who had done her in. Tom, knowing that he was the main suspect and the last one who purportedly saw her, decided it's high time I get out of here. I'm going to leave Happy Valley. That was the River Valley where he lived in that town. Like, you know how you have certain names of little communities and areas. He skipped town somewhere between June 25th, June 26th. On June 28th, a warrant was actually issued for his arrest, as well as for the arrest of Anne Melton.
Okay.
And a posse headed out after Tom.
But there was no body yet.
Still no body. I'm glad you picked up on that. That is actually a point in this story. He headed across the state line to Tennessee. He stopped along the way, changed his name to Hall, I guess his last name, stopped in Watauga County, worked as a hired man for a Colonel James Grayson. He only worked for him maybe a week or so, just long enough to earn money for some new shoes. He had worn his out walking. Okay. It didn't take long, though, for his pursuers to catch up to him, and they took him into custody. They brought him back across the state line into North Carolina, and he was put in the jail at Wilkesboro. Eventually, Pauline Foster was arrested. She had made a comment in jest. She was in Tennessee one night, and a guy named Ben said to her, "You and Tom Dooley killed Laura Foster." And then she replied, "Yeah, I and Tom Dooley did it one night." And she said she was joking. And you know, sometimes you make offhanded, funny little comments like, "Yeah, I'm the one that did it."
They took that seriously.
Yes, and she was arrested 2 or 3 weeks after that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that also made Anne Melton very mad because she implicated Tom Dooley in the murder by saying that. And so Anne was furious with her. Anne told her, "You've given them enough information to hang you and Tom." So I was getting ready to say here, keep in mind, there is no body found yet. Therefore, they are being held for suspicion of murder, but there's no proof of a murder. For all they know, Laura has run off with someone else.
Right.
Some would argue that holding him during that time was illegal because there was no proof of a crime being committed yet.
Right.
So that could have been unconstitutional. John Foster, in his book, kind of talks about that a little bit. So now the time frame moves to September. September 1st, Pauline was released from jail because she had started talking to authorities. Apparently, she had shared with them some details of a fight she had had with Anne Melton. And I do mean a fight, not just an argument.
Okay.
And Anne had told her where Laura's body could be found.
Oh.
She took the searchers to the general area that Anne had shown her of where Laura had probably been buried. As they searched, one of the men's horses started rearing up, pawing at the ground in a certain area. So they all go over there to see if there's anything going on. They take some sticks. They're kind of poking around. And that's when they discover a shallow grave.
Oh, wow. So they found her body in September.
In September. Okay. And this had happened in the late May. I'm going to read an excerpt from the book by John Foster West. "Lift Up Your Head, Tom Dooley." And this describes what Dr. Carter found when he examined this poor girl's body. The body was laying on its side, face up. The hole in which she lay was 2.5 feet deep, very narrow, and not long enough for the body. The legs were drawn up. Such a wound, supposing it not to have penetrated the heart, would not necessarily be fatal, though of a dangerous character. If it had perpetrated the heart, it would have necessarily been fatal. The body was in so decomposed a condition that I could not ascertain whether the knife had cut the heart or not. The clothing around the heart was in a rotten condition. That's the end of the quote. So basically, he's saying, you know, if the knife had gone into the heart, then yes, it's fatal. If not, then it may not have been fatal. And he couldn't really tell because the body was too decomposed to tell whether it had actually penetrated the heart or not. I wanted to discuss the possibility, because this is one of those things that kind of freaks me out a little bit. What if it had not penetrated the heart and she wasn't dead when they put her, or when somebody put her in that shallow grave?
Was she too decomposed to tell if there was dirt in her airways?
they didn't say, and I don't know if they even checked.
But, to do that, yeah.
But that examination didn't really give any more detail than that.
That's awful.
I hope there was not. I hope it was quick.
I do too.
You know, because just that thought of somebody putting you in a grave and covering you up, and then either you bleeding out or I don't know. It's just, that's terrifying to me.
It always baffles me that somebody that you're intimate with, that you can then go on to like look them in their face or yeah. when you murder somebody, but if it was him.
Yeah. I will say this about, I mean, that was just my speculation when I read that about it. They couldn't tell whether that knife had gone in the heart.
Yeah.
And whether she died immediately. And I was like, oh, that just kind of gives me the creeps. But later on in the actual bill of indictment mm-hmm. for Tom, it does state that she died instantly.
Okay.
So I don't know if other doctors or coroners researched and examined her and determined later that it had. Again, it's really hard to find good information about the case that's factual. And so I did research, but I couldn't find that.
Okay.
Her body was then taken to Cowell's store in Elkville, where several others examined it to confirm it was Laura. Now, I thought that was interesting that they took her to a store, because remember when you did the episode about the Lawsons?
Yes.
They were also taken to a store.
Yes. We heard over there in Madison that back then a lot of funeral homes were like doubled as stores.
Right. And so when I read that, I thought, oh, that must have been what was going on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was in North Carolina, too. So.
Exactly. Not actually even too far. I mean, this was further up into the mountains.
But right.
Several others examined the body, and they confirmed that it was Laura. Her father and Pauline both said they could tell by her teeth, which were large, and it had a, she had a large gap between her teeth.
Okay.
And so they could tell. And they both recognized the dress that she had on as well.
If her dad did love her, though, how sad would that be to identify your kid like that?
I know. Can you imagine? And because, again, her body was already pretty decomposed. Mm-hmm. It was several weeks later.
Yeah, that's
several
awful.
Months later. Her body was then taken to her resting place on the bank of the Yadkin River close to her home. And her grave is still there today with a small gravestone marking it.
Oh, we need to go see that.
I know. I wanted to tell you. I think we need to ride up there and see it.
Yes.
Ann Melton was then arrested. Now, remember, there was already a warrant out for her arrest, and I don't know why they had not arrested her before now.
I was wondering why they arrested him before her. Dang.
Because I saw the actual document of the arrest record or the warrant for Tom and Ann.
Yeah, that's weird.
So that was odd. So she was arrested. She was incarcerated. She was put in the same jail in Wilkesboro as Tom Dooley. It's reported that they were put in adjacent cells with just a wall between them. Tom was charged with the murder of Laura, and Ann was charged with abetting him to murder and aiding him after the fact. Zebulon Vance, who was the former governor of North Carolina.
I have gone to his old home place.
Have you?
Yeah, like not that long ago. Curtis and I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
And there, I know that there's like some kind of a monument statue in Raleigh of his.
Oh,
I mean, he was a governor.
Yeah.
Well, so because he was the ex-governor, and he was actually a Civil War veteran.
Okay.
Well, he took an interest in this case. So he took on both Ann's and Tom's cases as defense attorney.
Interesting.
That is interesting, yeah. Legend has it that he did so because Tom had served under him in the Civil War. But that's actually most likely just legend and not facts. Now, they did both serve in the Civil War, and so maybe he knew of Tom's record or what have you, but there's no documentation that Tom actually served under him.
Okay.
So nobody really knows why Governor Vance or ex-Governor Vance was so keen to help Tom.
It could have been just the war, you know.
Maybe, because you got to think this was taken, the Civil War wasn't over until 1865, and this was 1866.
Yeah.
That was not that far in the rearview mirror here. You have that bond with your brothers in arms,
yes,
so to speak. So maybe that was what it was. Maybe he was a fellow brother from that time.
Yeah, and he just wanted to make sure he got a good defense.
Yes. And he did. He managed to get the trial moved to nearby Statesville because he said they're not going to get a fair trial here in Wilkes County.
Right.
So they got it moved to Statesville, which was more likely that they would get a fair trial. And he managed to get Tom and Ann's trials separated so they would be tried separately. And we had another episode where we talked about somebody being tried together
Yeah, it was The Lonely Hearts Killers.
Yes. So I just didn't realize that that happened so often, because I would think it's a given, like, you need to have separate trials.
I don't think they do that now.
Yeah, I would think not.
That's crazy that they were ever allowed, because there's no way to get a, I don't feel like, to get a good defense that way.
Right. I don't think so either. So that was one of the things that Governor, or I guess at this point, Attorney Vance mm-hmm. did for them. The state laid out the motive as the one you've just been hearing, that Tom thought he had gotten of a nasty venereal disease from Laura, and that he had transmitted it to Anne. So they were both angry about it, and they were out to get revenge. And I think maybe in Anne's case, maybe a little bit of jealousy was probably included there.
Oh, sure.
After two trials where he was found guilty both times based on circumstantial evidence, let me add that, Tom Dooley was found guilty in both trials and was sentenced to be hanged by the neck until dead.
Okay.
During his last night in jail, it is said that at first he was non-repentant of the crime, continued to deny his guilt. One jailer came in and discovered that one of Tom's ankle shackles had, there was a link that had been filed through with a piece of glass that Tom had hidden in his mattress.
Ah.
So it's assumed that at that point he was still hoping to escape. So maybe that's why he's like not admitting to it and not really feeling too down about his circumstances.
Yeah.
However, since it was spotted, those chains were replaced with secure ones, and it seemed that Tom finally became resigned to his fate. In the hours before his hanging, he gave a short written note to one of his lawyers, which read, quote, "Statement of Thomas C. Dooley. I declare that I am the only person that had any hand in the murder of Laura Foster, April 30, 1868. Unquote.
Wow. Wow.
But he made sure that he said, I don't want the contents of this note read until after I'm dead. I think he might have still been holding out some hope that he could declare his innocence.
Right. Maybe they would, yeah.
Yeah.
Have mercy or something.
Maybe. I think maybe there was always that little bit of shred of hope for mercy. Finally, Tom is starting to get nervous. Sometimes he would be seen fervently praying. Other times, mumbling incoherently or pacing in his cell. Those kinds of things. Finally, the time came for his hanging, and he was brought to the gallows by a cart carrying the coffin that he was to be buried in.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I wonder if that was like a normal practice. Probably. I'm thinking you got to have the coffin there to put it in, the body in.
Yeah.
He was, at that point, smiling and even reassured his sister that he had made his peace with his maker.
I feel like that was a thing. Because I was thinking about Tom Wolfork.
Yes.
And how he was, you know, he was nervous, but he
decided to take it like a man.
Yeah.
Yeah. To be strong in the face of certain death or
right.
whatever. I think you're right. So Tom was given a chance to say any last words, and he did.
Okay.
He spoke for over an hour.
Oh, wow.
Maybe he's still trying to buy time.
Seriously.
But it said he spoke with a booming voice about a lot of different things, about politics, about people Goodness. Who had lied against him in their testimony. He still swore there were people and neighbors and friends who had lied against him. And a lot of other things. He covered a lot of topics in that talk. It's even reported that he, in spite of that written statement that he had already given over, which had not been, the contents had not been read yet, in spite of that, it is said that he declared at one point, "Gentlemen, do you see this hand? I didn't harm a hair on the girl's head."
Oh, goodness.
But when he finished, the rope was tied to the gallows, the cart was moved from beneath him, and he fell just 2 feet. Now, hanging is supposed to break the neck, causing a quick death, but 2 feet is not a distance enough for that to happen. So therefore, 10 minutes later after the fall, he still had a pulse.
Oh, my goodness.
But, kind of referring to what you had said earlier, he didn't make a struggle. You know how some people struggle against the noose, or I don't know. I've never seen a real hanging, obviously, but on TV you see them struggling and mm-hmm. jerking around. They said he did not do that. So I wonder if that was him facing it bravely, because he's hanging there for 10 minutes before he's pronounced dead.
I kind of hope that I'm hoping that they lose consciousness.
Maybe, hopefully, because if you deserve that, and I believe some people did.
Right.
That's still a pretty harsh thing to see and to think about, a way to die.
It is.
It's a bad way to die. And I said that he hung there for 10 minutes. I need to correct that. At 10 minutes, he still had a pulse. At 13 minutes after the fall, they pronounced him dead.
Wow.
But they let him hang for 20 minutes, I guess to be sure, before they cut his body down. And then his body was taken back to Happy Valley and buried there under an apple tree. Some myths say that he was actually hung on that tree. Like, if you go even now to that area and talk to people, some people say, yeah, he was hung right there at that tree. But he wasn't. He was hung in Statesville, where he had been sentenced, and then his body brought back.
Okay.
That was just one of those, like, legends that kind of gets passed down.
Now, does he have a grave marker?
He does.
Okay.
He does have a grave marker. I think we should go visit.
We should.
There's actually a museum about that, and they say that the townspeople will talk to you about it. Much like when we went to Madison, and the townspeople were very keen to just tell us all about the Lawson family murders. I believe, from what I've read online, it sounds like this the same thing. You go to this small town, and the people were ready to, you know, tell you what they know, what they've heard from their grandparents and great-grandparents have passed down, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, we definitely need to do that.
And like I said, there's a museum there, and I'll leave a link to that museum's website at the very in our show notes. It's called the Whippoorwill Academy, I believe.
Cool.
Afterwards, Ann Melton was tried for the charges against her. For some reason, the charge of her being an accomplice after the murder had already taken place was dropped.
Really?
So she was only charged for aiding and abetting him and influencing him to commit murder.
Okay.
And by then, the note that Tom had written was read to whomever needed to hear it. Her trial was pretty brief because she had pretty much been exonerated by his admission. And a lot of people believe that he just did that so she wouldn't have to hang for it as well.
I wonder if he loved her.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think maybe, you know, since he realized I'm not getting out of this and I'm going to hang for it anyway, I'm going to spare her. Because maybe, I mean, they had been neighbors all their lives.
Yeah.
They had supposedly been intimate since the early age of 13 or 14. I think there had to have been a really close bond between them. Sure. I think they did love each other. So she was exonerated and acquitted after she had been in jail for like 2 years before that trial.
Okay, so she spent some time.
She did. And then she returned home to her husband and had two children.
Wow.
And lived another decade.
Okay.
With syphilis.
Now, did syphilis kill her?
Well, let's talk about it.
Okay.
Let me say this. Popular opinion was that she was a part of that murder in spite of Tom saying all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So she probably was not a very popular member of the community after that.
I'm sure.
They've got this young girl who's been murdered.
And they probably didn't care anything in the world about her when she was alive.
Exactly. Probably not. But actually, now, she had that reputation. They probably talked badly about her. But now she's gone. And so, you know how that kind of goes. Yeah. Well, one of the most retold legends about Anne's death is that as she was dying, she started screaming that she could see black cats climbing the walls and could hear meat frying in hell.
Oh, my goodness.
And I know that sounds crazy, but there could actually be a logical explanation for it. So this whole tale started with the whole syphilis outbreak in there, in that community. Many cases of syphilis will become benign after a certain amount of time.
Okay.
So I believe you might still, you know, have that dormant in your body, but it's not, you don't have those symptoms. And again, I'm no doctor. I'm just going on some things that I've read. I could be getting some things wrong there.
Okay.
A small percentage of cases of syphilis will go on to become secondary.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of those will even progress to a third stage of advanced syphilis. One of the symptoms of advanced syphilis is that it can attack your brain and spinal cord. That's called neurosyphilis. And what happens is it can cause produce dementia-like behavior.
I think Al Capone had that.
Really?
Yeah.
And I believe we need to research and do an episode on him. That would be interesting.
That's interesting. Same situation.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I did not know that. that dementia-like behavior, you know, it's like loss of memory, violent outrages, and delusions.
Yep. Mm.
I think it's quite possible that she could have been suffering from this disorder of the neurosyphilis before her death. What do you think?
Yeah, that sounds about right. I just I wonder if she was young, because wasn't Tom Dooley was young, right?
He was in his early 20s when this happened. He was like between 22, 23.
And they were close to the same age.
Yeah. I think she may have been a little older. So let's just say if she was 23 when it happened. Yeah, she was probably only in her mid-30s, because it was only like a decade later.
Sure. Then that's highly possible.
Very highly possible. I don't know. That was my speculation on my part. Okay. My personal opinion is that even though she got acquitted of the crime, I think she did have a hand in it. I mean, she had made threats and comments.
Right.
She had said she was going to kill Laura Foster. She was jealous of Laura Foster. I think she was involved, very heavily involved. She didn't get any jail time she spent 2 years in jail awaiting trial. So she did get 2 years. But she didn't really get, she did get acquitted for the crime. But sometimes the personal consequences of your choices can be worse than that. And I just feel like, you know, her personal consequences caught up with her, and that was her justice.
Right. Okay. So one thing that I wanted to ask you about, the fight between her and her cousin.
So apparently she was threatening Pauline that you're not going to tell. She wanted Pauline to like cover for her. She was telling her, you know, you're not going to tell people that, you know, where this grave is and that this happened and that Tom came, you know, just the things that Pauline knew from living in the house.
They told her all of this stuff, or she overheard. Yes. Okay.
She was like a firsthand account witness to most of it.
Gotcha.
But not there at the murder.
And she did clearly know where the grave was.
She knew.
Okay.
She's threatening to kill her. Well, a neighbor overheard that conversation. And so then Anne went to the neighbor and threatened to kill her if she told what she had heard. But apparently she got Pauline on the ground and was choking her.
Oh my gracious.
Yeah, like it was like a real fight. Like she was throwing her around, threatening her and choking her and stuff.
Okay, so yeah, she sounds guilty.
She sounds guilty to me. Mm-hmm. Or at least if she's not, then her behavior is making her look guilty. So she needs to quit that behavior.
Right, exactly. So true. So did it all come out about Pauline having syphilis?
At some point, it must have.
Okay.
Since we know about it now.
Yeah.
Or some of our listeners may already know the answer to that. And if you do, go to our Facebook page and leave a comment on this episode.
And I was just thinking, she could have been more a part of it than she let on as well, because, you know, she could have very well helped out in all that.
Yeah.
Now they just turn state's evidence so that they get a lesser penalty. And she could have just done that to kind of, she could get out of it.
I mean, they did arrest her for some reason.
Right.
So maybe she just threw Anne under the bus.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Which Anne was probably.
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying, like you said, maybe she had a little bit more part in it than she made out in her testimony on trial.
Right, because I don't feel like she's very trustworthy if she's hiding the fact that she has syphilis and probably giving it to everybody.
Yeah, it's just crazy. There's also another story about Anne.
Okay.
That when she was on her deathbed, she whispered something to someone who was leaning over her deathbed. And a lot of people that have passed that down through the ages say that it was a confession.
Oh, okay.
But that's one of those legends, who really knows kind of thing. Well, we do know that after her death, her husband, James Milton, he was able to remarry and have more children and live a happy life for many years.
So the syphilis didn't get him.
So, yeah, I guess he didn't die of the syphilis. And I'm thinking her two children, wouldn't they possibly have been born with syphilis?
Could have been.
Because that can be passed through in childbirth.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that concludes our story for today.
Wow, that was a good one. Very informative.
Those sure were some hard times.
Yes, they were.
Now, those were some hard times. And I'd like to thank you for listening and let you know that we really do appreciate your support. I'd like to remind you that no matter where you listen to your podcast, you can go ahead and subscribe to Hard Times and True Crimes and light up all 5 of those stars. And if you're listening on Apple, you can go ahead and leave us a quick review. You can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, you can leave them at hardtimesandtruecrimes.com. Now, I know we've all got a million things that can keep us up at night with worry. But according to Dr. Fauci, if you tell everybody you know, and a few people you don't, to check out Hard Times and True Crimes, you'll never have to explain to your spouse how you accidentally got syphilis. Till next time, goodbye.
Dug the grave 4 foot long and you dug it 3 feet deep. You poured the cold clay over her and you stomped it with your feet. Hang your head, Tom Dooley, hang your head and cry. You killed poor Laura Foster and you know you're bound to die.